Hello, I'm Annie Hastwell. Welcome to Let's Think About It, the program where Radio Adelaide goes free fall into the rich world of ideas, especially those explored during 20 years in which Adelaide hosted the Festival of Ideas. It was a time when celebrated thinkers from around Australia and the world came to Adelaide to give their take on the problems of our times, how we live and where we're headed. So, since some ideas are timeless, on this program we pick the best and give them another run. World-renowned physicist and best-selling author Professor Davies believes that great ideas aren't always recognised at the time. Their moment in the sun comes later. He'll talk shortly about everything from dark energy and the Higgs boson to cures for cancer. And later in the program, an interview with author Andrew Ware, whose book Solved looks at countries which have cracked some of the world's biggest problems, like achieving 100% renewable energy or extending lifespans. First to Paul Davies. He argues that great ideas often languish in obscurity until decades later they burst into relevance. And he's curious about what else lies in what he calls the dusty storehouse of human ideas that may yet transform our future. In this wide-ranging talk, Professor Davies discusses everything from cosmology and information theory to new ways that cancer could be understood and ultimately treated.
The American physicist John Archibald Wheeler was fond of saying that great leaps in science owe more to the clash of ideas than the steady accumulation of facts. A healthy society is, of course, one that has a free marketplace of ideas, and a good university is one that should be a ferment of ideas. Now, in science, ideas come in all sorts of varieties. Very occasionally, a sudden flash of inspiration will produce an immediate breakthrough. The best-known example of this has given our language the very word eureka. I'm referring, of course, to the mathematician and inventor Archimedes, who famously leapt from his bath and ran down the road naked, shouting, "Eureka, I found it!" What he'd found was a way to test for the purity of gold by measuring the weight of the metal immersed in water. Those of you who remember your school days will recall that this is dignified by the term Archimedes' principle. Now, in this case, the solution of the problem was immediate and spectacular. But those eureka moments are very rare. Often in science, an idea undergoes a long period of gestation and may languish in obscurity for decades or even centuries before bursting into the limelight. Classic example of this was Archimedes' predecessor, Democritus, who in the 4th century came up with the idea that all matter is made of atoms. It took over 2 millennia before the existence of atoms became fully accepted. And you'll see here a picture of 3 beryllium atoms taken at NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, outside Washington, D.C. So we can now actually see atoms, with our very eyes. But this was a long period coming. Richard Feynman, perhaps one of the greatest of 20th century theoretical physicists, said that if all other scientific knowledge was wiped out and you could keep just one thing, then the existence of atoms would probably be the most profound and important development. But it did take a long time for it to catch on. Now, I should say, just to bring this up to date, that the objects we call atoms today are not what Democritus had in mind. In Greek, atom is aton. It means no cut. You can't cut it. They are indecomposable fundamental entities. And the things we call atoms today, we know are composite bodies. They've got bits and pieces inside. They're electrons, and the nucleus has neutrons and protons, and the neutrons and protons have quarks and gluons. And in addition, there are 3 types of neutrinos, and there are muons and tauons. And so really rather a long list of entities there. But there is a faith among physicists today that although what we call atoms are not the thing Democritus had in mind, at some fundamental level, some base level, there would be particles which could not be broken apart into anything smaller. And maybe they're not particles, maybe they're little loops of string. And that's led to what is called the standard model of particle physics, and it's a list, and I just rattle through them all, but I left one out. The one I left out is called the Higgs boson. And it's inevitable I will mention it because just last week, Peter Higgs and his colleague François Englert it was announced, they will be awarded this year's Nobel Prize. The Higgs boson was conceived, theoretically, with some of the mathematics shown there on the board behind Peter Higgs, in the early 1960s. And it's taken over 50 years for this particle to be definitively identified. And so this is a plateau of sorts, but nobody working in particle physics thinks it's the last word. There's surely a lot more to be learned out there. Now, many ideas in science are like this. They don't go away, but they don't attract a great deal of attention. And there's a very long list. Continental drift, space travel, time travel, teleportation, rogue planets, quantum computing. All of these were conceived a long time ago, and all of them, more or less, are coming true now. So in the interests of time, because I don't want to keep you here all night, I don't propose to go through all of these topics. What I thought I would do, as befits a festival of ideas, is to take a handful of ideas that have been on the back burner for a long time, but are now starting to show their worth. And these ideas I've selected because they've had a direct impact on my own research. And so don't be dismayed. There are only three of them, and I hope there's something for everybody. So let me start off with this one, anti-gravity. Now, when Newton famously saw the apple fall, what he saw was more than just a falling apple. What he saw was the law of gravitation, which affects not just apples, but all objects in the universe, all planets and all stars. And this is known as Newton's universal law of gravitation. And if you know anything at all about gravitation, you'll know it's a pulling force. It's what keeps our feet on the ground. It's a force of attraction. And right away, Newton was faced with a puzzle because it seemed to him that if all those stars out there in the universe are all pulling on each other, there's really nothing to prevent them all falling down into the middle, into a crunch. What is to stop that happening? And so what was to prevent the universe from collapsing? And he didn't have a very convincing answer. But a couple of hundred years later, along came this gentleman, Albert Einstein, with his famous theory of relativity. The special theory of relativity was published in 1905, and he generalized this theory in 1915 to include the effects of gravitation. I don't intend to explain this theory in any great depth, except to just make the comment that unlike with Newton, who regarded gravity as a force of attraction between two bodies, say the Earth and the Sun, Einstein presented gravitation in a very different conceptual framework as the warping or distortion of the geometry of space-time. No matter, it still led to that same conundrum. What is to stop the whole universe falling into a big heap somewhere in the middle? And in 1917, Einstein extended his theory of gravitation to the universe as a whole, a theory of cosmology, published in 1917. And in that theory, in that paper, he proposed a solution to the collapse of the universe. In fact, he invented, in effect, anti-gravity. And this graph, this is the only graph I think I'm sure. No, it's not. It's not the only graph, but it's simple. This shows the force of gravitation, and it shows how, with distance, it diminishes. And I think you probably all know that, that if you get far enough away from the Earth's gravity is weakened. Better way of thinking of it, Mercury that goes around the Sun much faster than Pluto because it's closer. So gravity gets weaker with distance, like that. His anti-gravity was very strange. He proposed that this is a force that is very small at close distances but gets bigger with distance in that linear manner, twice as far away, twice the push. so that the universe would be subject to a tussle, gigantic tussle, between gravitation that wants to collapse everything and this hypothetical anti-gravity that is counterbalancing it and pushing it in the other direction. And it's universally called lambda, incidentally. And the plan was that these two titanic forces should be in equilibrium. Now, you might say, well, wouldn't we notice if there's anti-gravity around? And the answer is, well, it doesn't help Weight Watchers very much because that's about the amount by which your weight is diminished. If you can't read that, 10 to the power minus 26 grams is all that Einstein's lambda anti-gravity does for you. But nevertheless, as I've mentioned, it gets bigger over great distances, and so taken on a cosmological scale, it ought to add up to be something very significant. Well, unfortunately, the idea didn't work very well, and one reason is because this balancing act between the attractive gravitation and the repulsive lambda force is unstable. So all it would take is for somebody to sneeze, the universe would begin to expand a little bit, and that would make it bigger, the lambda force would get stronger, and that would lead to a runaway expansion like this. And conversely, if there was a fluctuation in the other direction, it would lead to the collapse of the universe into a crunch. But that wasn't why Einstein abandoned it. The reason was he went to the United States in 1931 and he met this gentleman here, unusually seen without his pipe. This is the most famous lawyer in history. He started out on the dark side, but then he saw the light and he became an astronomer. And he discovered that the universe is expanding. And Einstein didn't know that, although the evidence for it had accumulated in the 1920s. So when Einstein learned this, he was seriously upset because he figured that if he'd never introduced that lambda term, he would have had to conclude that the universe can't be static. It would either be collapsing, which would be bad news, or expanding. So he would have predicted almost certainly that the universe is expanding. Missed the opportunity for this fantastic prediction and never really got over it. He called it the greatest blunder of his life. Well, this is many decades ago. And so once again, well, I should say, when I was a student in the 1960s, nobody really had a good word to say about this lambda force, about this Einstein anti-gravity, or cosmological constant is what it's usually called. But then, surprise, surprise, in the late 1980s, Australia's very own Brian Schmidt, who received the Nobel Prize for this work, along with his colleagues, discovered that, yes, the universe is expanding, we all know that, but that it's expanding faster and faster, that the rate of expansion is picking up over time. It's accelerating. How could that be? What is causing the universe to accelerate? Well, this is what the picture looks like now. Big Bang, the universe starts out expanding very fast, and then there comes a sort of intermediate phase where the forces of contraction and the forces of expansion are sort of slugging it out. The forces of expansion win, and the universe is now on this runaway trajectory to faster and faster expansion. What's causing that? Well, it's led, the discovery of this accelerating expansion has led to a reappraisal of what the universe is made of. This is the pie chart of the universe, and you see, normal matter, what do I mean by that? I mean things like atoms, you, me, the sun, the stars, gas and dust, and so on, makes up only about 4% of the total mass of the universe. Then there's this other 21% so-called dark matter. What's that? Well, we don't know. But, if, for example, it could be very massive particles that interact only weakly, so they just go straight through you and maybe straight through the Earth as well. And there's a list of such particles that might be out there. But we don't really know definitively what they are, but we're hot on the trail, some sort of dark matter. But you see, the lion's share is this area here, this so-called dark energy, which is what it's become known as. That's my watch. Don't want to overrun. So it's called dark energy, largely because we don't really know what it is. But there's one simple way of explaining how to describe it. Dark energy, the reason it's dark is because it's nothing more than the energy of empty space, or the mass, if you like, of empty space, E equals mc squared, same thing. And you might think, well, why would empty space have any energy? To which I would reply, why not? The thing is, how would you know whether empty space weighed something? It's not like you can get a chunk of empty space and put it on the scales and weigh it against something else, because space is all around us, so you can't isolate it in the manner here. So we don't know it's precisely zero. And that dark energy, the green bit in that pie chart, is, as far as we can tell, nothing more than the energy of empty space. We'd like to know, why has it got that amount of energy rather than some other amount? We don't know the answer to that. But it really does look like this energy of empty space is dominating the dynamics of the universe. Now, when you look back in history, you find that the energy of empty space is, in fact, none other than Einstein's cosmological term, this lambda thing I was telling you about. And so, although it's too soon to say that is what it is, it seems to me, for my money, that there's no reason to look beyond that, that it is just the idea of antigravity that Einstein suggested all that time ago, and now it is clearly the dominating factor in the universe. So that's a great idea of an idea that went away and then came back again, and if Einstein were alive today, I'm sure he would regard it not as his greatest blunder, but as his greatest success, greatest triumph. Well, let me move on to subject number two, which is the origin of life. So I'm very much involved in that at the moment. I have a large research grant to work on the theory of the origin of life. So everything I'm going to tell you is really theory. Now, let me start off not with the origin of life, but with something that everybody today would recognize. This is the computer. Actually, I realized after I made this picture that it's not the computer. It's just the monitor and the keyboard. But the computer will be there somewhere. And this seems quintessentially a modern contraption. These sorts of gizmos are part of what defines our modern age. But the idea of the computer goes back a long way. In fact, it goes back to the work of an eccentric English genius, Charles Babbage, who in the early part of the 19th century came up with the idea of the contraption that you see here on the right. This contraption was... well, that's a reconstruction, I should say, of the Science Museum in London. But this contraption was commissioned by the Admiralty because they wanted a much more accurate and faster way for printing log tables and trigonometric functions and so on for navigational purposes. And they paid Babbage a lot of money. He squandered most of it because he actually wasn't all that interested in the difference engine, as it was called, not all that interested in something that would just churn out, say, log tables. What really interested him was the concept of the analytical engine, which he came up with in 1837. And we'll see in a moment, the analytical engine is, in a sense, a general-purpose, programmable, universal computer. If the analytical engine had been built, it could, at least in principle, if it could get the thing to go, could compute any computable function. So the basic notion of the modern general-purpose computer was already there in 1837. And this story has a particular resonance for South Australia because both Babbage's sons emigrated here to Adelaide, and Herschel Babbage, named after the astronomer, in particular, was a very prominent figure here in Adelaide, and he helped, he went with Colonel Light and helped survey the interior of the country, and he's buried in St. Mary's Churchyard in Edwardstown, if anybody's out that way, go and take a look. But his name is misspelled. So I'm grateful to my friend Duncan Steele, who was a great Babbage fan. Incidentally, both the Babbages are the first two signatories in the Book of Members of the Royal Society of South Australia, which is housed in a building not very far from here. So you can go along and see their signatures. Well, now fast forward to the Second World War and to scenes like this. Anyone who knows anything about history will know that around about 1940, 1941, Britain was struggling for its life because it could be supplied by ships traveling across the North Atlantic, but lurking in the North Atlantic, were German U-boats that were sinking the ships in huge numbers. And the U-boat commanders relied on this cunning device here called the Enigma coding machine. And it's, I won't go into the details, but there are these wheels and you can plug things in down here and so on. And there are said to be so many combinations in this Enigma machine that only the NSA could break the code today. Britain had its own secret weapon in the form of this gentleman here, Alan Turing, one of the great unsung heroes, although starting to be sung, in the history of science. So Turing was a mathematician interested in the foundations of mathematics and logic, and he published a famous paper in 1936 on the logical architecture that would be necessary for a general-purpose computable system. He had some sort of contraption in mind that bears no relation to real computers, but the basic idea of something that could compute anything that was computable by a general-purpose procedure was something that he'd set down. And so he got recruited by Churchill and put in this place here, Bletchley Park, where all the code breakers got together and managed to break the Enigma code. If you're ever in the south of England, do go along to Bletchley Park because it's just full of history and a very fitting shrine for this mathematical genius, Alan Turing. I took the trouble to go along. You'll see me here with playing with an Enigma machine. They usually won't let you do that, but my brother was involved in giving them some money to restore their roof, and so I had some credibility. And I'm there with my sister, and you see my wife's even interviewing me as I do this this little ritual here on the Enigma machine. But anyway, the upshot was that idea of Babbage, that analytical engine, finally came to fruition in the year 1940 when Alan Turing built the first electronic programmable computer, which was called the BOM, with an E on the end, at Bletchley Park in order to assist in cracking the Enigma code. Now, the United States wasn't in the war then, but eventually they reluctantly came in, and of course they weren't to be outdone, so they wanted their own computer, and that was built by this gentleman here, John von Neumann. It was built at Los Alamos, and it was used later on in the war to help with the Manhattan Project, and it's amazing how many students at my university in the United States have no idea what the Manhattan Project is. They think it's some sort of real estate development in the Big Apple, something of that sort. So if there's anyone here who doesn't know what it is, it was the Atomic Bomb Project. Now, the reason I'm mentioning all this, you might think, well, what's all this got to do with the origin of life? I'll get into that. The point being is that what von Neumann recognized is that from the logical point of view, there's a very close connection between a universal computer and a universal constructor. A universal constructor is a machine or a system that can produce any specified, by a program, any specified object or machine or structure, including itself. That's the key point. So that leads to the notion of a von Neumann self-replicating automaton, a machine that could not only make lots of other things, but could make a copy of itself. And of course, that comes very close to the concept of a living organism, because a living cell, for example, can make a copy of itself. But crucially, it doesn't just crank out another cell and that cell is inert. That cell can make a copy of itself and so on. In other words, the instructions, the program, if you like, that are part of the magic of life is part of the replication process. So here's a system which has the logical architecture necessary to make a copy of itself, including its own set of instructions. So that's a very profound notion. What it's showing us is that life is really an information replication and management system. Just hold that thought. Life is really about information processing and information management.
You're listening to Think About It, Radio Adelaide's Ideas program. And here, physicist Professor Paul Davies is speaking in 2013 at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas about the really big questions like where life began.
Now, how did life start? I said it's about the origin of life. Quick answer, we have no idea. But what is the problem we're trying to solve? Well, this is one problem. We'd like to know how the stuff of life got going in the first place. And there was a very famous experiment in 1952 by Miller and Urey, and the purpose of that experiment was to try to cook up the building blocks of life in the lab. And that was pretty successful. The amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, are really very easy to make, and anybody here could do that. Really doesn't cost very much, doesn't require too much expertise. Going beyond that turns out to be fantastically difficult. And really, very little additional progress has been made in trying to make life in the test tube, in effect. In other words, the pathway from the simple building blocks to even the simplest living thing is still an immensely long one. We have no real idea how that pathway was traversed, but presumably there is a sequence of transformations that took a chemical mixture, a network of chemical reactions to the first living thing. But all of what I've been saying in the last couple of minutes refers to what we might call the hardware of life, the stuff of which we're made. I read somewhere that if you die and they take your body to some sort of chemist and then you decompose the body and get the bits, get the elements, and then sell them on the open market, you'd be worth a couple of dollars or something. So really, we're not worth that much in terms of, you know, the actual content. What makes a human being valuable is not what we're made of, it's how it's put together. And so we might think of that as the software aspect of life. So we have the chemists trying to make the hardware of life, but then, remembering back to von Neumann, life is really about information processing and information management, the software side of life. That's been completely neglected for over 50 years. So this is another idea whose time has come. Why has it come? How can I say that? Well, none other than Paul Nurse, the president of the Royal Society. His view about the nature of biology is that we need to describe the logic circuits that reveal how information is managed. So you see, it's about logical architecture and information management, exactly as von Neumann had said back in the 1940s. Now, I mentioned that I've got a big research grant for working on the origin of life. And our approach is that alongside the chemists who keep beavering away, we're going to try to come up with what does it take for a network of chemical reactions to spontaneously transform themselves into a system that can process information, even digital information, in a way that gains causal efficacy or management over the microscopic degrees of freedom. So it's a very profound concept. And I have to say right at the outset that the real brains behind this project is not me. It's Sarah Walker here. And Sarah is carrying what she likes to describe as her only experiment in the origin of life. That's young Corbin there. And he comes to all our seminars. He's got to be the most educated three-month-old, I think, because he sits in on all the seminars and discussions about the origin of life, and we hope it will stand him in good stead. And so this is work which is only just beginning, but it is recovering those early ideas of von Neumann, that life is not about stuff, it's really about information management. Let me come on now to the third of the topics, which is the origin of cancer. It's in the title of this lecture, From Cosmology to Cancer. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about a story in cancer, which is another one of these great ideas that has sat on the back burner and is now coming back into vogue, if only in minority circles. And I'm going to talk about the work of Otto Warburg, people often say Warburg, a German biochemist who did such fantastic work during his career that he's the only person to be nominated three times for a Nobel Prize for three completely different bits of work. He did receive the Nobel Prize in 1931, and he had a particular he made discoveries about the nature of cancer, but he had a particular point of view, which is that cancer results from a dysregulation of the metabolism of cells. Cells like ours, so-called eukaryotic cells, that are aerobic, they take in oxygen, and this oxygen is processed in little organelles called mitochondria, and that's what gives us the energy to run things. And he conceived, well, he discovered that what happens with cancer, if you turn the oxygen down, the cancer defaults to an ancestral type of metabolism called fermentation. It's what you use to make beer. And it does that quite happily. Healthy cells will do that as well. But when you turn the oxygen back up, healthy cells go back to what's called oxphos, or oxidation phosphorylation, go back to that. But cancer cells prefer the low oxygen or so-called hypoxic conditions. They actually prefer to be in that. He thought that was a really profound discovery and thought that the secret of cancer lays with trying to understand how metabolism goes wrong. Now, I have to say that Warburg fell out of favor in the scientific community because he became Hitler's oncologist. Now, I have to say it was probably a smart career move at the time, but history does not judge well of him. And so his science has rather been obliterated along with his name. But in recent years, the idea that cancer might be some sort of metabolic disease is very much coming back into vogue. Now, if you know anything at all about cancer, that you'll know that mainstream cancer research is limping along painfully slowly. And so there's plenty of room for alternative ideas. And this is not such a daft idea, but it is an idea that has been on the back burner for a long time. Now, I should contrast it with the mainstream view of cancer, which is, and this is a paper from Nature very recently, a couple of months ago, I'm calling this the damaged genes paradigm. And there, that first sentence is, well, the first sentence in the abstract of the paper says, all cancers, not some, all cancers are caused by somatic mutations. I think the statement is simply factually incorrect, but I think it's deeply misleading. But it is the central paradigm that cancer is a disease of the genes. It's not a metabolic disease. Now, how does this connect with my research? Well, I should mention right now that those of you who are interested in the cancer research programming that I'm directing at Arizona State University should come and hear me on Sunday afternoon, because you'll have an entire 45 minutes or whatever I get on just this aspect of my work. But this is just a trailer or a taster, and I should say right at the outset that all of the ideas that I've been developing in cancer research have been done jointly with Charlie Lineweaver at the Australian National University. And the basic idea that we're developing is that we call it the throwback theory, or the atavistic theory of cancer. Cancer is a throwback, that is, it's like a default to an ancestral phenotype, an ancestral life form, if you like. So it's a reversion in that sense, and that the evolutionary roots of cancer can be traced back a long way, not just thousands of years. People think cancer is a modern disease. It's anything but. Not just thousands or millions of years, but right back to the dawn of multicellularity. When was that? Well, we think about 1.5 billion years ago, 1.5 billion years ago. We think cancer, the roots, the evolutionary roots of cancer go back at least that far. Now, what makes us think that? Well, one thing is it's a mistake to suppose cancer is a human disease. It's widespread among multicellular life, seen among all mammals, with the possible exception of the naked mole rat, all mammals, fish, birds, insects, and even plants. And so something that is so widespread in nature clearly has deep evolutionary roots. You have to go back to before the common ancestors of those different species, and that takes you back a very long way. Now, because I'm going to talk about it on Sunday, I just bulletized the sound. I was actually thinking of showing bullets here, but I thought that might be a little tasteless. But I bulletized the points. The first point is that cancer is deeply embedded in the logic of multicellular life. It comes, it's a concomitant of multicellular life. You can't do multicellularity without, because of the logic that leads to the selection of communities of cooperating entities, this logic inevitably will produce something like cancer. So in other words, cells in our body come preloaded with a cancer subroutine. I like to think of it in computer language. That this subroutine is very ancient, evolved a long time ago, and so the key genes in that subroutine, if we could identify them, we'd see a very widespread among species. And cancer results as an inappropriate upregulation or expression of these very ancient genes. And so in that sense, it's a default to this ancestral phenotype. And you might say, well, why are these ancient genes retained? Why didn't evolution remove them? And the answer is they play a critical role in embryogenesis, the early stage of the embryo, and also to a certain extent in wound healing and the immune system. So they fulfill a very useful function. But when they are inappropriately expressed, in later years as opposed to in the embryo, then cancer is what results. So we think cancer is not a whole lot of cells that have gone wrong. It's not an accumulation of genetic damage. We think cancer is really an accident waiting to happen, like a genie in a bottle. The genie is fully programmed with a well-defined and highly efficient agenda, which it will execute if it can get out of the bottle. And the execution of that agenda is what we would call cancer initiation and progression. It's the genie enacting its pre-programmed response. We think the cancer's triggered because of a variety of stresses in the microenvironment of the cells. So it's a response. The cancer is a response to a stress. So the genetic dysregulation that we see in cancer, we think, is a consequence of the cancer, not a cause. It's primarily response to some sort of crisis or stress in the tissue microenvironment. Now, you can shatter the bottle in many different ways, but once that bottle is shattered, out comes the genie, and that part's very predictable. The mainstream cancer community has got fixated on the shards of glass, using sequencing technology to see if there are any patterns among the genes associated with that debris that has released the genie. And so these elusive patterns have become the main goal of cancer research these days, in the hope that somehow looming out of petabytes of data describing those shards of glass will be the answer to cancer. We think the answer to cancer is there all the time, and we just have to understand its ancient evolutionary roots. Now, how do we make contact with Warburg? Well, our theory has a very specific prediction, because what we're saying is that if you have healthy cells in your body and you have cancer cells in your body, the cancer cells are recapitulating an ancient lifestyle. And we know what that ancient lifestyle was, because we know enough about history of life on Earth and the history of the Earth to know what conditions were like a long time ago. And in particular, if we're right that cancer goes back to the dawn of multicellularity, we know something about planet Earth 1.5 billion years ago. And one of the things that we know is there wasn't much oxygen around. There was very little free oxygen. There were two great oxygenation events in the history of life on Earth. Here's number one. Here's number two. The origin of multicellularity, which we think is the roots of cancer, are in this plateau here where the oxygen content of the Earth's atmosphere was just a few percent. And the second great rise in oxygen didn't occur till about 800 to 600 million years ago. So we actually predicted right at the outset that cancer would prefer hypoxic conditions. And sure enough, then we discovered the work of Warburg, and we think that this is a good confirmation point. Falls far short of having our ideas accepted by the cancer research community, but we're working on it. Now, of course, when you talk about cancer, people might say it's a fascinating theory, but what are its therapeutic implications? What can you do with this? And it does have therapeutic implications. And the reason is that standard of care cancer therapy targets the strengths of cancer. One of the things cancer is very good at is proliferation. Cancer cells replicate seemingly unstoppably. And lots of drugs and radiation and other treatment surgery are all about trying to stop that or slow down that replication. But cancer's really good at doing that. That is an ancient strength of cancer, its replicative ability. There are others too. We think the best way of tackling cancer is to target its weaknesses What are those weaknesses? Well, if cancer is a reversion to a more robust ancestral phenotype, the cancer in going back and reverting is going to divest itself of some more modern modalities. And when I say modern, I mean evolved over the last, say, 500 million years. So cancer will be unable to meet the challenges of the modern world as well as healthy cells do. And among those challenges are high oxygen compared to 1.5 billion years ago and low sugar. I should have said beer makers will know. Fermentation means sugar. Cancer loves sugar, hates oxygen. And so one possible way of treating cancer is to use hyperbaric oxygen therapy, is what you see here, combined with dietary restriction, in particular glucose restriction. And we're having a workshop just next month with all of the people who think that this set of ideas will fly. Sort of gloomy topic number three, but I'm going to end on a high note because it seems to me that a festival of ideas should always be looking to the future. And so what ideas are out there now that have not yet come to fruition, but which promise to do so, maybe not by the next festival of ideas, but perhaps, you know, in another 50 years or so. And I've just picked a few of my favorites, and the first of these won't surprise you. Can we create life in the lab? Will some mad chemist somewhere be able to do that once we've informed this chemist about the software ingredients? Who knows? There are people out there trying to do that. Then another favorite of mine is going to Mars on a one-way ticket. Are you crazy? You'll be thinking that would be a suicide mission. Nobody would do that. Well, I'm not talking about a suicide mission. I'm talking about simply sending a trailblazer, maybe two, maybe four, astronaut to the red planet to establish a permanent human presence there, a colony that in the fullness of time would grow and grow and would become another place in the solar system for human civilization and human culture to thrive. And it's an idea that I suggested in an article in the New York Times way back in, if I can read the date, I think it was January 2004. A few people thought that was entertaining. Not very many people took notice. But goodness me, just in the last year or two, suddenly everybody's talking about one way to Mars and volunteers are flooding in. This website here says 100,000 sign up for a one-way ticket to Mars. I'm sure there are people here tonight who just can't wait to do it. Rather than coming up to me after the lecture, I would prefer that you went to this website here, Mars One, put your name down. I think they charge $40 for you to register. No doubt names will be drawn out of a hat in the fullness of time, and who knows, it might be you. That's the one way to Mars idea. It's an idea whose time has not yet come, but it's an idea for an idea. And I think the idea has now come. Maybe the reality will be there in 30 or 40 years. We shall see. And the final thing that I just want to give a nodding mention to, wouldn't it be nice? This is an old idea of communicating with extraterrestrial beings if there are any out there. And there may be none. I hope there are, but I don't know. Can we communicate with them? SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is an idea in its modern guise that was started about 53 years ago, I think, and it rumbles on. So far, nothing, but we would like to know if there's anybody out there, and it would be wonderful to think that this great idea would once again be one of those that just comes back from the back burner and bursts into the limelight. Now, I'm going to give the last word tonight to one of Adelaide's great sons, Lawrence Bragg. He was born in North Adelaide in 1890. He died in 1971, got Nobel Prize for his work in X-ray crystallography, which he shared with his father, who was Professor of Physics and Mathematics at the University of Adelaide. And a picture of young Lawrence there on the left. And he had something to say about ideas. And what he says, it uncannily echoes, although it should be around the other way, what John Wheeler said that I quoted in my opening address, and could, I think, be an emblem for the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. So this great mind from Adelaide had the following, and these are the last words, the following to say about ideas. The important thing in science is not so much to obtain new facts as to discover new ways of thinking about them.
World-renowned physicist and best-selling author Professor Paul Davies, who, by the way, also has some very interesting ideas about the possibility of time travel. There he was speaking at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas in 2013. You're listening to Think About It, a brand new program from Radio Adelaide on which we check out ideas of all kinds. In this next talk, we meet author and policy analyst Andrew Ware. He's written a book called Solved, in which he's investigated examples from all over the world of countries that have actually solved some of the problems other countries wrestle with or give up on. He starts here with the example of Denmark, which will reach 100% renewable electricity by 2030, all through one project on one island. How do they do it?
The Danish government put out a call for entries for an island in Denmark or a peninsula that could become the first carbon neutral community in Denmark. And Samsø Island, a small farming community of just under 4,000 people, won that competition. And that then provided funding for a community development worker to bring together the local community to, over many years, work towards carbon neutrality. And today that community, every resident now produces negative 3.7 tonnes of carbon every year.
So there's a couple of things in there that you contribute their success to. One of them is engaging the community right from the start.
Yeah, in Samsø Island is a conservative farming community made up of farmers who are farming beets and sheep, etc. And a lot of their efforts didn't require an ideological commitment to tackling climate change. In fact, they were often about strengthening the local farming community, improving the efficiency of production, etc. So the community were engaged through town hall meetings, through meetings in people's kitchens, and initially wind turbines were proposed for the island, and community members were invited to co-own those facilities or go in through cooperatives to purchase those facilities. And as a result, many of the community had an economic stake in the success of the wind turbines and giving them an alternative source of income. And that really got the community on board. And other initiatives they did were community-owned biomass boilers that provided communal heating that was piped through to people's houses in each of the villages as well, fueled by biomass that was grown in the paddocks of the community.
One of the other factors in there, you say, in Denmark is the absence of a fragmented media. So we all remember the huge fuss around the big coal tax in Julia Gillard's time. Does it help to not have that polar argument, those polarities of argument going on all the time?
Yeah, the interesting thing about Denmark is that everyone gets their news more or less from the same sources. There's two government-owned TV stations that everyone, regardless of their political disposition, is getting their news from. And that, although there's differences of political opinion, everyone's having the debate and the discussion in the same location. They're not off talking only to their own like-minded people. So everyone's forced to engage, and I think that engagement builds trust over time.
But Australia's a different story. What would we do here? Like, we've got, how do we deal with the coal and mining lobby if we were looking at a similar kind of thing, how to get rid of fossil fuels? Yeah. How will we engage the community, and how will we get people to get past this idea that you have to have baseload power of some kind?
Yeah, well, I think what the Denmark example shows us is that a couple of things that are prevalent in the Australian debate aren't necessarily true. So, for example, Denmark, over the last couple of decades has halved its per capita carbon emissions, but at the same time, the Danish economy has grown strongly. It's faster, in fact, than the Australian economy. So you can reduce carbon emissions and grow the economy. The Danish economy too has shown that you can eliminate baseload power and coal-fired power from the mix and still have very high reliability. In fact, Denmark by 2030 will eliminate its last coal-fired power station, and it has the highest security of supply of any country in Europe with 99.99% reliability. And that shows that I think that if Denmark can do it, through a sophisticated network of transmission and connectedness with other sources of supply, then Australia potentially can too. And so, although we're not Denmark and we have a different political culture and we have a different background and history, the fact that Denmark can do it and shows that it's both technically possible, that it is feasible to reduce emissions and grow the economy, should give us hope as well, I think.
Now, another success story that we can kind of relate back to Australia is Korea, South Korea, you know, which had a dire life expectancy and was a pretty crippled country after the war, and now has the most extraordinarily long life expectancy. Can you just run me through quickly that Korean example of how you do that, how you create a healthy country?
After World War II, Korea was in a very dire situation, as you lay out, with some of the worst life expectancies in the OECD. And soon we'll see that South Korean women will live to an average of over 90 years old, the highest in the world. And Korea manages to have an extraordinarily high-level government health system with some of the best hospitals in the world, for example, a universal healthcare system, not dissimilar to Medicare. And what I think differentiates Korea from a country like Australia is the maintenance of a traditional diet, high in vegetables and other fruit and vegetables, etc. So what that means is that although you've got good healthcare, you've also got good underlying health conditions with relatively low smoking rates, low obesity rates, low rates of diabetes, which is enabling people to live increasingly long and healthy lives.
Is there any lesson to be learned for Australia in there? Like, I'm thinking of the indigenous life expectancy that we deal with.
Yeah, I think there absolutely is. There are some lessons for Australia. Is that you can have the best healthcare system in the world, but it won't have the same impact if other lifestyle factors are pushing in the other direction. We really do need to be taking whatever measures we can in remote communities, in rural communities, to ensure that people are able to have a diet rich in fruit and vegetables and other healthy foods and not rely overly on fast foods, that we need to support people to live healthy lifestyles with exercise. With some lessons that we can learn from a country like Korea, Australia can potentially turn itself around too and not go the direction of the United States, for example, which although it has a fantastic hospital system, if you can afford it, life expectancy on an average in the United States has actually gone backwards over the last 10 years, principally because of those diet and lifestyle factors.
Just going to pluck one more example out of your book, and that's the gender equality example that you use Iceland as an example of. Now, in the 1970s, Iceland had pretty poor gender equality. Women were paid 40% less than men. And then they had this big Women's Day off, and that started a movement that's led to a society that really is quite gender equal. What are the policies that have brought that about?
The Women's Day off, it saw more than 90% of women in Iceland refuse to go to work or refuse to look after children or do their domestic duties in the home. They filled the streets, and the streets were then filled with the smell of burning meat as the men tried to cook that evening. And what that showed is that the role of women in society was absolutely fundamental, and it really led to a shift in political debate. So for the majority of years since that point in the 1970s, Iceland has had a female prime minister or president, and Iceland has had some quite impressive measures, such as they've now moved to 12 months of paid paternity leave at 80% of people's previous paid parental leave, which is available to both men and women. They've got extraordinarily affordable childcare. Gender equality for pay is actually mandated by law, and companies have to prove their pay is gender equal or face fines under the law. Board seats for companies have a mandated quota for women. There's a whole host of measures that Iceland has taken. And I think what they've shown us is that gender equality doesn't just come about by accident. It actually requires concerted efforts, agitating, and legislative change to make it happen.
And one of the interesting things is that allowing men to spend more time with their children when they're young through parental leave for both parents has quite a big effect in the long run on the role of the two people within the family.
I think it's absolutely critical, because in the long run, we're not going to see equality in the workplace between men and women unless we also see equality between men and women in the home, because they both go hand in hand. We need more men to be spending more time at home with children and family so that to make it more feasible for women to spend more time in the workplace. That's good for children, it's good for men, it's good for women. And the policies that we put in place to support that are really critical, and we've seen that in Iceland and a number of the other Nordic countries as well, and I think there's a lot for Australia to learn from those examples.
And that's what you get to at the end of the book. It's like, well, we could do this. These are all the things that we could do. What policies would you like to see adopted in Australia that could make a difference to us in 10, yeah. 20 years' time?
That's right. And I think 10, 20 years' time is the operative time frame. Is a lot of the examples that I point to in the book have not been quick fixes. They've been examples that have occurred over decades. And Australia needs to have the courage to have a big vision about where we could possibly get to in 10, 20 years' time. I think we need to be thinking about how we can increase our tax revenue so that we can fund initiatives such as improved paid parental leave, improved kindergarten for three-year-old children, for example, expand Medicare to include services such as dental. We really need to seriously double down on our education system. We're getting left behind by many of the countries in East Asia. So there are a number of things that we really do need to do urgently, and climate change is the obvious one that leaps out as well. Our emissions per capita have not reduced at all in the last 30 years. Countries such as Denmark show us that it's possible. We really need to be considering how we can do more too.
Now, you work with the Victorian government. Do you get any feeling that policymakers, that politicians are reading your book, getting some ideas from it?
I've certainly had a lot of feedback, and a lot of people were very enthusiastic about discussing some of the ideas. Not necessarily all of the ideas will be implemented in the short term. I think what this is about, though, it's about expanding the conversation so that the menu of policy options is larger than it might otherwise have been, so that we can take inspiration from what other countries are doing successfully and ask ourselves, could it, would it, should it be possible to do this also in Australia? And in some cases it will, in some cases it won't. But what it does do is it expands our conversation of what might be possible.
Andrew Ware, author of Solve, that's published by Black Ink. You've been listening to Think About It. Every week we'll be bringing you more ideas to think and talk about. As presented to Adelaide audiences over many years at the Festival of Ideas, Writers Week and WOMAD Planet Talks. And we'll also feature new interviews with current thinkers. Our thanks to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas for access to their extraordinary archive. You can have a look for yourself at adelaidefestivalofideas.com.au. Thanks too to Clayton Werner, Tim Carter and Nick Crowther for their help in making this program possible. I'm Annie Hastwell. Join us again next week for more wild ideas.